Thank you, Jacob. It's a real pleasure to be with you. It's a great pleasure. We have not known each other or shared before today, so I'm really grateful to make new friends and likewise to perhaps make more friends with everybody here. So thank you for having me. Just to be clear, I'm not really going to be talking about the Anglican liturgy today. That's for this conference that we're at. Okay. My title, it's alliterative, Mortality, Morality, and Mystery. And I'll explain this as we go along, but this is basically about how mortality shapes our ethics, or ought to in some sense, as well as opens up our hearts and minds theologically. Let me begin with a small personal note. And that is that after almost 2 years of steady decline and real physical suffering, my father died just a couple weeks ago at the age of 95. And I had a conversation with my 70-year-old sister, who lives far away in New Zealand, about all this. And we talked about the emotional element involved in the loss of our father. Yes, we agreed, we're both deeply sorrowful. But no, we are not broken with grief. And it's not just because he was already a very elderly man at 95 and had lived a full life. Rather, it was the fact that both she and I were both much older ourselves than when our affections were first nurtured by our father. And my sister said, given our age, I'm 65, she's 70, given our age, we are both now wrapped up in death, she said. We realize that it is part of who we are in a way we never did when we were younger. Now, of course, she's right. And I think anybody who gets older and so on recognizes this in some way. So what I'm going to do in what follows is to provide a very condensed, so I'm warning you, logical and thus somewhat abstract argument for this observation, if you will, that my sister made. And in a few minutes, in other words, I want to lay out an entire theology by considering what it means to be, quote, wrapped up in death. What it means, that is, to realize that we are born to die, as some have put it. That the very nature of our being is shaped by our liability to and final certainty of dying. Now, it's well known that younger people are less attuned to this reality, though how much that is our present culture rather than a universal sensibility among the young, I'm less clear. I think it's mostly the former. I do think it's probably more the culture for various reasons. But somehow, eventually, most people do realize that their lives are actually constituted by their dying. What they have done, the relationships that they have had, their loves, their disappointments, exhilarations, sorrows, all of these are entwined with a deep transience. And they're resonant with a kind of sense of our final limitation as a destiny. And as this realization grows, that is to say, as we age, the world actually begins to look different. And our relationships shift in their substance. As a pastor, and as Jacob said, I've been a pastor for 25 years actively in different church settings. I have met a few elderly persons who are deeply afraid of dying, but not many, actually, not many. I have met, however, many elderly people who are puzzled and even lost in the face of their deaths, or finally, simply perhaps filled with regrets and gnawing frustrations, something that is perhaps more disturbing than fear. But have I met people who are terrified by their deaths? Hardly ever. I'm talking about old people. The reality of mortality, which I'm addressing this evening, is fundamental to who we are. The category is definitive of our being. Not only does death mark the limit, the literal defining a boundary to our lives in a temporal sense. Our lives end just as we die. But far more profoundly, this ending characterizes everything we do as we live. We only begin in one place. We can only ascend so far or descend to such a boundary. We can only think for a few days. We can only react within very strict parameters, and so on and so on. Everything about our existence is about starting and terminating, and doing so within a very narrow scope, and finally, necessarily. There's no alternative to this. I point out this comprehensive aspect to mortality because, in fact, mortality in our era is something we approach mostly only temporally, rather than as something that defines our temporality, our sense of time itself. The very reference of the word in contemporary writing, the word mortality that is usually to a punctiliar medical event, as in rates of mortality that you can trace, for instance, over this or that period of years, and so on and so forth. If you look at academic discussion of mortality, you can also trace over the past century a shift of interest away from the broader notion of mortality as referring to the limited character of our lives, of human life. At best, this is somehow something only that philosophers worry about. You can trace a shift from that over the last 100 plus years to one that is focused quite narrowly on what some people have called the death process. That is, to the physical or biological mechanism of human disappearance and decomposition itself. So if you look up the word mortality in titles of books, that's almost always what they're talking about. Bestsellers by Newland and others are about what happens to our bodies when we die. They're not about what does it mean to be a human being who dies. They're two very different questions. Interestingly, this shift to mortality as event, rather than as condition, has given rise to its own cultural outlook, sometimes called the death awareness movement. I don't know if you ever heard of this, but there is such a thing, which is aimed at trying to get people to look unblinkingly at our temporal demise and to put on, if you will, your big boy pants in the face of the fact that we are all going to die. The death awareness movement can either be nihilistic, sort of a life sucks and then you die bumper sticker, or morally, soberly, don't overly invest in anything, be mindful of the present, and so on and so forth. And there are a whole bunch of books out there about this. You may not have come across them, but they're bestsellers. One popular book from this perspective is by a very well-known journalist named Oliver Berkman. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. The 4,000 weeks in question being the average lifespan in weeks, about 80 years. Books like Berkman's, How to Live Moderately Given That You Will Soon Die, can rightly be seen as an effort to retrieve the traditional understanding of mortality as a natural condition, but for our era, now purified of its mostly, as they're viewed, religious confusions, in the form of what is basically a modern Epicureanism, sometimes colored by Buddhist intuitions. These are bestsellers out there now. But as I understand it, and my understanding, yes, is coherent with traditional religious views, mortality engages the quality or set of qualities that inform our existence as a whole. And of course, existence presumes life. Mortality then is essentially a kind of life. Indeed, as I will point out, it is the whole of life. It is what life is. Mortality is not a kind of death, except insofar as death also presumes life. Mortality on this reading is a vivified and vivifying reality that permeates human life. As the poet Yeats wrote, "Nor dread nor hope attend a dying animal. But a man awaits his end, dreading and hoping all." The all here encompassing the breadth of human perception, thought, and feeling. That is to say, animals live without knowing that they live. And do so in the shadow of a certain death, whose form, however, remains uncertain. Human beings, however, know they live, because they also know that they will die, and therefore their knowing is always anxious. What this indicates, then, is that mortality is a rich existential reality, not simply a temporal metric. Mortality is lived. It's not something that is simply observed. And while this may seem obvious, it's mostly forgotten in our culture. And with that forgetfulness, religious faith itself, I would argue, easily dissolves, because I think the two are essentially connected. Mortality's features, in fact, are not individually quantifiable at all and cannot be measured as such. In other words, saying simply, this person lives 95 years, this one 15 years or 44 years, as if we were only talking about the temporal identity of a single organism. Rather, the comprehensively existential character of mortality that takes in reactions, responses, communications, activities, and their meaning signifies that our lives are always given in a complex contextual framework. One that, in the case of human beings, is inevitably social. We are social beings. Everything about us is connected to something else. A human life always takes place somewhere, and that where is necessarily defined by other human beings. So, if mortality is about limits, it is about the way limits are always presented within a network of people. One cannot ever simply say, I am born and I die. Properly, one must say, I am born and I die because my life is given from, with, and to other lives. To talk about mortality is always to talk about a human person within a set of complex, though limited, relationships. Mortality is essentially an anti-individualistic reality. After all, you're always born to somebody, and you will always live because of other people, and you will die in some kind of shape that has been given by other people. What some of these more socially oriented features of mortality are is quite numerous, but I'm going to list a few right now. And if they seem obvious, don't kid yourselves. Most of us don't think this way about ourselves consistently. So first of all, these are aspects of mortality that I'm trying to list right now. First of all, dependence on others and on other things. We live because we are born from parents and are placed within a landscape of things and people and the vast realities and experiences that take them in. Other lives, other places, other experiences, other histories. Mortality means dependence on something outside of us. Two, interacting dependence. That is, our lives do not just appear from and among others, they persist in this network of interaction so as to biologically survive, to learn, to experience what one might call meaning, that is, the identifiable experiences of joy or sorrow, hope, interest, all of which only appear within a life with others. Everything about our limited life is bound up with other people and our interactions with them. Three, the limited scope of all aspects of this life is clearly bound up with our mortality. Because our mortal lives are defined by their interaction with other mortal lives and creatures, everything about us disappears quickly. Relationships, productivity, and so on. We can only impose ourselves upon the world to a very tiny extent. Furthermore, such self-imposition is experienced only in a context in which these elements are always shared, reshaped, coerced, wrenched away by the limiting forces of others and of our environment. So, limited scope of this interactive dependence. Fourth, mortality is characterized in our lives by the dynamics of what I would call catastrophe. The fact that virtually everything in our life is dependent on other people and on context outside of us Everything about our lives, therefore, can change radically and quickly based on all these other things and their own limited scope. So think about Ukraine right now. Think about the terrible floods in Pakistan just a month ago. Our mortality in its limiting definition is ever imposed upon us as a vast and frightening burden that takes in everything at once sometimes in a way that mirrors our own personal deaths. Sudden endings are a feature intrinsic to mortality. And that is why the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry, as the quote goes. And any settled plan will most certainly go awry. Now, all this leads to two more elements, more qualities, as it were, that color the essence of what it means to be alive as a mortal creature, and that orients all of our relations in the course of our lives. So, number five, our lives are about reception rather than assertion. Most of our lives is about things we receive from others and from outside of ourselves, rather than about what we make. Limitation means externality, and its experience can only be received, cannot be willed, and it cannot be escaped. So reception is essential to what it means to be a mortal creature on the very fundamental basis of our being at all. But the corollary of that, number six, is dispossession. Rather than possession, describes the temporal dynamic of our lives as a whole. That is, to live is to exist in such a way that most of what we receive is also taken away. Indeed, at some point, it is all taken away. That's what it means to die. That is the underlying direction of our lives. And it is central to the biblical assertion. As Job says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return. Now, none of this, these are six things, is meant to sound grim, although it probably does. I am, in fact, simply providing what I believe is an empirical description, that's all, of things as they actually are. This is just what a human being is, like it or not. What we do with this reality of who we are, of course, is another matter. There are, to be sure, huge implications to these kinds of inbuilt and inescapable constraints on our lives, all of which characterize our mortality. And hence, a failure to take mortality seriously will result in a failure to live truly. Truly in the sense of honestly, as well as in the sense of being in tune with the truth, or as Stanley Hauerwas, the theologian, put it, with the grain of the universe. So, for instance, we must ask ourselves, since in fact our culture's formative thrust no longer provides us with such answers, we must ask ourselves, what accounts for this mortal life that we have? And how does this accounting properly shape our attitudes and decisions? Because if we don't ask this kind of question, we are most certainly going to live dishonestly. And ours is a culture of dishonesty on almost every level in this area. Now, I believe that to ask the question, what accounts for this mortal life, and how does this accounting properly shape our attitudes and decisions, is to press us directly into the realm of existential inquiry within which the Christian gospel makes immediate sense, indeed is grammatically coherent. It fits, if you will, perfectly. It is true that while a few people commit suicide, most do not. And they do not because they sense that our mortal life, understood in the way I've just outlined it, is indeed good and is filled with goods worth cherishing. Most people recognize what these goods are, furthermore. Having children, having a family, experiencing and giving affection, having common meals with other people, drinking together, expressive song that one sings with others. Most people labor and so on. Even aching sorrow is a good within this kind of context, most people believe. Furthermore, to account for these goods, most people intuit that like everything else, these goods are given to them, given to us as goods, rather than merely constructed by us as diverting pleasures. Remember, as I mentioned a moment ago, that reception is a key element in mortality. We are shaped to be receiving beings. If there are goods in our lives, these goods then are given to us. They are not invented by us. And if truly good, finally, we sense their given character is grounded in our nature, in the nature of a reality that is larger than our own experience, because that's the nature of being mortal. Thus, mortality, just because, and I want to stress this, just because of its limitations and imposing interactions, seems to indicate that we are given something good in our lives, something that touches what is beyond the limits of our own being. The term human beings have given to this aspect of their mortality is a familiar one: createdness. To see myself as a creature, in part, means that I recognize that my limits are not my own. They represent something actively provided from elsewhere. My limitations do not just reflect who I am. They are part of the shape of the whole world that is itself given from beyond itself. And thus createdness, that is being a creature of a creator, has been the most usual and universal existential premise people across history have drawn regarding their mortality. Note the two things go together absolutely intimately. Now, as I warned you, I'm running through a logic here, not exploring it. But it's a very profound logic, and one shared, as I said, by almost all the peoples of history, most of whom felt their mortality with much greater acuteness than you or I do. There certainly are, and there have been, alternatives to this logic, but they have been confined to a few elite and educated minorities, and it's worth understanding that. Ancient and modern Epicureans, that primordial philosophy of exhausted materialism. What is, just is, without remainder. We just come to be from the matter of an unoriginated universe, and this coming to be is but one minuscule moment in an infinitely large and complex process of cosmic movement, whether evolutionary or deflationary. That's basically what our modern materialistic scientific worldview is, but it's also one that goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. We can either enjoy this moment, according to this view, and its peculiar contours somehow, or not. But the choice is simply ours, and there's no reason one way or the other. But all anything is, according to this view, is matter in movement. The Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg, or the Pulitzer Prize winning poet Mary Oliver, are two examples of this very elite Epicurean vision. The one is a theoretical physicist, the other a preternaturally sensitive poet. But these are hardly popular exemplars. We may have heard of them. Maybe we read these people, but either now or in whatever form in the past. Epicureanism was and still is a social luxury. It has little to do with the shape of human life as it has been shared across time. To be sure, there are many people today who live their lives as practical Epicureans, giving little thought to the origins of their mortal existence. But they also live at the same time, and this is not a paradox, it's obvious that they would, with the practical belief in the transcendent value of their mortal goods, their children, their parents, their families, their work. The fact that in modern Western societies, the notion of createdness has fallen away as a ground to this sense of mortality's goods is a cultural phenomenon rather than one of logic. I want to press it. There's nothing logical about the fact that people no longer think of themselves as creatures. It's something that we've been shaped by a cultural current into taking on ourselves. But if at the same time, just these, we go back. We are mortal. And if we're mortal and limited, dependent and receptive, and our actions are relativized in their effects within constrained temporal and causal bounds, but if at the same time, just these constraints, just this mortality, constitute the shape of our existence as given by a creator, that is, by God, then all the elements that are ingredient to our mortality have been, just in this recognition, granted a divine significance. That's the key logical consequence I would underline here. For this consequence, in turn, leads us to locate goodness itself and the pursuit of goodness, or honest and true existence, in the actual realities that define our mortality, not somewhere else. A true life, a life with God, that is, will be one bound to personal dependence, i.e. birth and nurture. A true life to God, with God, will be bound to humanly networked survival and its meaning. That is to say, family and local community. And such a true life will be defined by toil and struggle, protection, weakening, and death, but also by the generative elements that derive from this, procreation itself and the ongoing continuance of created life. So that's my first part. That's mortality. And mortality, if we think about what it is who we are. There's no question about that. Whatever the rate of our lifespans has changed and so on, the rate of mortality is still 100%. There's no question about that. So if we bear that in mind and take it seriously and think about what accounts for it and what we're accountable to because of it, createdness simply is a given. It's a given, and if you don't want it, you don't have to have it, but you are left with nothing else. So let me move then to the second part of my talk. Mortality, now morality. Mortality, that is, leads to morality, at least of a certain kind. For mortality indicates the shape of our decisions for limited goods, goods received rather than manufactured on our own. But what are we given? Precisely mortal bodies. Our bodies, understood in their physiological framework, are the vehicles of our mortal existence. The intimate connection between body and meaning is given here in all of its press. In a way, mortality means that morality is always bodily. But created mortality, which is mortality's corollary, means that bodily life, therefore, is also divinely significant. It's spiritual in that sense. Bodily life is. The body-soul dualism that has been more or less prominent in Christian self-understanding has, as we know, risked obscuring mortality as a divine good from top to bottom. The Christian tradition has, in fact, wavered between two views of mortality. What I call the intrinsicist view, which says that our mortal nature, including our deaths, is and always was built into our created being. You are dust, and to dust you shall return, Genesis 3:19. Mortality is intrinsic to who we are as created by God. That's one view. An alternative view in the Christian tradition is the extrinsicist view that says that mortality was imposed on us subsequent to our creation by Satan, sin, a human mistake, and so on. However, practically, these two views, whatever individual theologians have said, and there is no dogmatic agreement here, no conciliar decree on whether mortality is intrinsic or extrinsic, you should know that. There is no orthodoxy on the matter. Practically, the two views have existed for Christians in a dialectic of experienced understanding, both together. More real has been the claim of the body's shaping of the soul. The body's priority over the soul, one way or the other. As Paul writes, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to what he hath done, whether it be good or bad." That sums up the bodily morality of mortality, right? There's an Anglo-Saxon poem that I like to use to make this point, entitled, of course, Soul and Body, in which the soul, in this poem, addresses the body. And the body's now dead. as it awaits the resurrection. The body, as it lies there with the soul watching its decomposing friend, is being eaten away by vermin and worms. And the soul can do nothing but look upon its former mate, its body, in a kind of paralysis, knowing that its soul's own fate, is bound entirely to what this corrupted physical pile of bodily rot once did. And so the soul says to the body, "You have to answer for us both at the day of judgment." That is, my fate as soul is bound to your life as body. And then the soul goes on, quote, "Then there will be no joint so small in your body that you must pay retribution for every one singly when the Lord shall be fearsome in his judgment. And what have we done for our sakes? We must soon afterwards brook twinned miseries, just as you, the body, have ordained for us here before." The soul is sort of, is upset at the fact that she can't do anything. It's all in the power of the body. And yet the two go together. Now, it's a bit stark, I admit. But the point, if you think about it, is really kind of liberating. This life in our body is our life. There's something wonderful about that. It's not somewhere else. This really is the life God has given me. We need peer under no rocks to get at the secret, or stand around with our eyes cast heavenward, tearing for an answer, or find ways to cast off what we have been given in the flesh in order to find the truth. None of that. Rather, our births, our parents, our children, if we have them, our families, our growth, our struggles, our toil, our loves, our generations, our losses, our pain, our illnesses, our weakening, it's all enough. It's all powered by the miraculous wealth and grace of God. The life of bodies, which are limited and offered up to God, is all the stuff of our spirit's life that it needs. It's not the spirit's shell. It's the spirit's very form. Now, if indeed the mortal body is tied up with eternal reality, that's fine. That's true. But it's tied up as mortal, as defined in the ways I've just listed. And the morality of mortality then will be different from a morality based on the bodily escape into immortality. Rather, the morality of mortality will simply follow the shape of the body's limits. As I said, birth, family, toil, survival, weakening, death. With meaning in the forms of joy, sorrow, hope, given just in the parameters and experience of these limits. In the form of its mortal limitations, morality, furthermore, is thus a matter of ordering these limits, all the things that are about just here. While there may be consequentialist outcomes to what is just here, what Jesus calls reward in heaven, just here, though, is not about rewards, by definition, because just here ends. So just here is not about just here rewards. If there are rewards, it's in a different dimension, as it were. And heaven is not about what is given just here. Just here means being born, living a certain way, and dying, and that this is enough to constitute the full gift of God. So what does it mean to order the limits of what is just here in our mortal lives? We can speak here of a design, though not in terms of a plan to achieve a purpose, but a design in the artistic sense of sketching the fundamentals of an outline, its proportions, its relative integration of parts. The Italian Renaissance had a notion of disegno, the Italian word for design, which, interestingly enough, was first applied to whom? To God. Design as the skeleton of beauty, some of them said. By analogy, we could say that mortality as ground for morality has no purpose beyond itself except that God has made it. Morality is thus what ethicists call deontological. It's based on what God gives, what God commands, you could say, not what we make up. To the extent that our lives are given to us in an utterly limited and temporally relative fashion, We can only act with what we have received from God. And we can only, we can only do what fits within the limits of this reception. We cannot change the constraints that have been placed upon and that define our lives. We cannot make them better in a way that outstrips what we are given relatively. Our bodies, our lifespans, our transient genetic and familial relationships, our labors simply to survive in the framework of a time that moves us from birth to death. Rightly ordering this small scope of bodily life according to God's will is, in this sense of disegno, beautiful. It is true. It is good. And all the rest is either irrelevant or ugly or false or evil. It's a very radical claim. The morality of mortality is very different than what we are taught today, according to which to judge our lives, which is all based on achieving something that is somehow beyond the present. It is, of course, in this context of mortal bodies that so many contemporary social disputes are being waged. We know that. But without much sense of the actual force of the limits this context involves. Our bodies are received as gifts, and they serve a brief mortal passage to death. And their constitution involves the generative and nurturing struggles of, yes, codependence. In this context, a good, not a bad word, with other people. Matters regarding the sex we are given, the shape of our bodies is given, their use, their relations, and their disposal, obviously, all come into play just here. Discerning our way through present disputes about all this, I realize, is not easy. But take out the utilitarian claims that are common in the ethics of our day. What do our actions get us as a utility? What do we get by acting in such and such a way? Take that out, as well as the conviction that time changes things for the better, amelioration, which can't because we only live a few years and we can't get much done. What we are left with is our bodies as they have always been, more or less, ordered in the few years granted us. Scriptural ethics is, I would argue, but the deontologically articulated form of God's inventive design. Remember, deontological means what God gives us simply from God's side, not from ours, whose tools permit our own limited crafting of a beautiful life. We can make our lives beautiful, but within this small scope of what we have been given. Interestingly, Scripture, and Paul makes this explicit in 1 Corinthians 12, speaks of beauty in just this moral way that is tied to mortality. He does so in a very peculiar fashion, using the term honor, or kabod in Hebrew. Honor your mother and father. Honor the emperor. Honor God. These are all things Paul says, and other people say in Scripture. What does honor mean here? It's related to the Hebrew word kabod, which is translated in English as glory. And both kabod, honor, and kabod, glory, refer to a kind of weight, a heaviness, a substance. To honor is thus to make or count something as heavy, as weighty. It's the same word, oddly to us, perhaps, that we translate in English from the Bible as harden, as when God hardens Pharaoh's heart, or as making the eyes of sinners heavy and thus dull. It's interesting. Honor and hardening are really the same word. When we honor parents or God, at work is a dynamic, you see, of gift and receipt, which, as I have been emphasizing, is at the core of mortality. We honor those to whom we give ourselves away, to whom we laden with the gift of ourself. And we are honored when we receive from them. Mortality is a way that God honors us because it is all gift. That's what mortality is. All gift without remainder. And its burdens reflect that giftedness. That is the this is not ours or this is not mine reality of who we are. And the deepest gift we can give is ourselves in expending our lives for another. The morality of mortality in this perspective is the ordered design of receiving and self-giving that which is fundamentally all that we have from God, our bodies. Let me just go off script here, because I had a conversation in the car, literally, 2 days ago. I was driving down to Philadelphia with a friend of mine in Toronto who is a little younger than I am. And he is, and his wife, they have 3 children. And the eldest of his children, his son, 2 other daughters, was born with very severe Down syndrome. Very severe. And I know the family well. And he's now 24 or something like that. You know, he can barely speak much, and he can't do really much, and so on and so forth. He's now in his 20s. And they have been caring for him and their whole life in many ways. They both have jobs. Their daughter is going to university. They have a life like anybody else, but it's all circumscribed by taking care of Rafi, his name. Somebody has to be there. They have to get this and that, and organizing and insurance and medicine. And I mean, I've watched this, everything. Who's there? Who goes? Who gets to do this and that? So I was talking to my friend the other day, and we were talking about something, and it came up. And he teaches a course in disability studies at a seminary. And he said, you know, it's very hard for me with my students to get them to realize that our relationship to Rafi really is a gift. Our need to take care of him and his burden upon us is actually what God has given us to make our lives full. It's a miracle, he says. Not that I've always enjoyed it, obviously. I mean, it's been a terrible burden in real ways. But he said, this is so hard for people to understand. So hard. And he said, at one point they had students, well, they weren't his students, but from some nursing school or something, who were doing internships and so on. And they were part of the, whatever the group was, who would come and help out with Rafi. And one of the things they did in their training was help him bathe. And he said, you know, most of us would think that helping some sort of, you know, not very well developed human being who doesn't really say much or anything, bathe, be naked, would be really hard. And he said all of them, these students, realized after doing this that there was something marvelous about just being able to cherish another body without any other purpose. Not their children, not sexual, not whatever. There's a body, and it needs cherishing. He says it's been transforming. Anyway, I meant that's part of what's going on here that I'm talking about. So honoring is the way that God speaks of the beautiful, and it's done bodily. So God honors us most fully then in what? The incarnation and the cross of Jesus, his son. And so too marriage, as a sign of that gift, is an honoring of the spouse. And so children honor parents by tending them, and parents their children, and on and on. The whole of the law, the Torah, outlines this design of mortality, or the morality of mortality. What is beautiful, in our sense of the term, is in scriptural terms, as I said, what is honorable, the image of the gift of God. When our mortal lives are so ordered as to cry out with all creation in Augustine's famous phrase, you have made me, you have designed me, then our lives have reached their perfection. And so here I turn to the third last part of the talk, mystery. Mortality, morality, and mystery, which I'm going to go very quickly as a conclusion. A morality of honoring, let us say, takes us into the life of God, of our Creator. Remember, createdness is the corollary of mortality. And thus, a life that honors our Creator, in the way that I have just said, createdness, so on and so forth, Yes, right. A life that honors our Creator in the way that I've just summarized it, ordering our bodies according to the designs of God given in Scripture, is one that reflects God's creating person somehow. The fact that our mortality is itself a revelation of God is its most powerful aspect as a gift. God shows himself to us in our mortal lives because he's our creator, you see. We only know God as our creator because we are faced with our mortality. So it's a revelation of God. God shows himself to us in our mortal selves. And this is what I mean by mystery. Translating the Greek of the New Testament, a mystery is the unveiling of a previously hidden purpose of God that, however, has for all its prior obscurity long been at work. So I'll just be clear. In the New Testament, a mystery is not something we don't know. It's hidden. A mystery is something that's actually revealed that was hidden, but it's revealed. It's revealed about our salvation. The word mystery in this sense is significantly used, as you may know, in Ephesians 5 on the subject of marriage. So I'll quote this section. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself. And the wife see that she reverence her husband. Now, I think this is a hinge text for all Christian life and ethics. And in it, the now revealed secret purposes lying at the heart of God's life as our creator are laid out in Jesus' death for the church, figured in the marriage of husband and wife, explained in decidedly bodily terms of joining and dying. And just in the context of husband and wife, the term honoring also appears, 1 Peter and elsewhere, and right after this when it comes to children. We order our lives, in the case, this case, the fundamental framework of husband and wife being joined and having children, literally dying for one another. Mutuality, by the way, is implied, not explicit, in an earlier verse. We do all this according to the single act of Christ Jesus. He is the perfect human being, we are told. He is the one new man, we are told. He is the second Adam, we are told. He is the image of the Father, we are told, in whose image we are both made and brought into conformance, we are finally told. So his body and what God does with the body of his son is what defines the miraculous gift of our own mortality. That is to say, the ordering of our mortal lives according to the morality of mortality, as I've indicated, is a revelation of the character of God. And the vehicle, the very form, the schema, the design, the beauty of our participation in God's life. You see what I'm saying? I'm saying that all the stuff I started with, all these things that, you know, we get sick and we die and we can't do this and we can't accomplish that and frustration, 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 all of that turns out actually to be the thing God gives us to have us enter into his life. It is a revelation into the mystery of God. So I want to end here reflectively. Mortality, morally grasped, is our divine participation, our divine image. And this does indeed go against a lot of popular and, to some extent, some traditional Christian perspectives. An exclusive extrinsicist view of mortality, that is to say, thinking that the fact of being in the midst of life, we are in death, must be the result of an evil imposition, that phrase from the prayer book. An extrinsicist view, if left unchecked, presses us to view our lives as ultimately a moment only, in which to plan and effect our escape from our lives. Why am I here? It's only to get things done so I can get out of here. That's what a pure extrinsicist view of mortality would be. Or it could be, anyway. Taken to the extreme, the extrinsicist view of mortality asserts that the body is a way station at best, a prison at worst. And the resurrection is then viewed as a recreation of something now discontinuous completely with the just here, with the just this body and these limitations. But I think Ephesians 5 gives the lie to this view. The mystery that Paul lays open in what I just read and talked about is that the divine Son of God reveals his divinity in dying for his church in a way that somehow comprehends the mortal life of husband and wife. And we can move on to children, honoring parents, and parents nurturing children, as Paul goes on to do in Ephesians 6. This life of honoring with our bodies, we are told, is the perfect human life. The perfect human life. The perfect life of the resurrected body, therefore, is of the body that dies for spouse. Now, I'm not sure how to parse this. We're also told that he will never die again with respect to Christ in Romans 9. Yet there he sits, our Lord, the perfect human being, upon the throne, we are told, quote, as a lamb that was slain. Whatever the case, death has not been wiped away. It is still visible somehow in the transcendent, miraculous transfiguration of God himself. Our future, then, it seems, is one of perfect sacrifice, whatever that means. Not no sacrifice. I don't know what it means, but I do know it means it's not no sacrifice. Without tears, we are told. But nonetheless, just this giving or being given away, thus this being delivered up. Or we could say immortality is a perfect mortality. It's not the opposite of mortality. It's the perfection of mortality. Now, to understand that, which I believe is the Christian gospel, is a project for our churches, certainly, and for our society in which we live and witness. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Radner, for this brilliant lecture. Very thought-provoking. We have time for questions, maybe 20 or so minutes. If I could start us out with one question that I'm sure several of us would like to ask. Could you maybe riff for a few minutes on how our Anglican tradition, with our liturgies and our embodied practices, kind of speaks to these realities of mortality and the morality that comes from there? Because we are most of us are kind of converts to Anglicanism, yeah. And we're just discovering these practices maybe for the first time. So maybe say a little bit of how that can inform us theologically about mortality and stuff.
So, and I teach a course in our seminary to young, well, we're not all so young, but to people trained to be priests ordained. On Anglican theology. And for a number of years, I taught it according to certain kind of streams of interest, how Anglicans think of the Bible, how Anglicans have thought of the creeds, and so on. I finally decided I'm just going to stick to the classic prayer book. The classic prayer book, it changed from 1549, when it first came out, to 1662, which is the final version that is still the canonical prayer book of the Church of England and many other Anglican churches. But they're all, well, some pretty big changes in between the first and second. They're all pretty much the same. And new prayer books tend to be quite different, ones from the later 20th century. So the classic Anglican prayer book of 1662. And I try to teach Anglican theology through the lens of this prayer book by looking at the different services and so on. One of the things I've been forced to do in doing that, of course, is to be honest about when it was written. Was written in the 16th century and the 17th century and so on, not in the 21st century. When you make comparisons between recent revisions and the classic ones, one of the places where one sees the greatest changes is all around this reality of mortality. It's fascinating. That is to say, now obviously if you have a funeral service, you can't get away from it, but you'd be surprised what you can do with revised funeral services to kind of dampen down certain phrases and so on. Fortunately, most of the revised prayer books that are used that I'm familiar with have kept most of it. But take that phrase which I mentioned, which is actually a medieval phrase that Cranmer translated then into English. One of the things said is people are marching to or walking to the grave. In the midst of life, we are in death. Of whom can we hope for succor but of thee, O Lord? Succor, help. That is a quintessentially prayer book view of who we are. I mean, literally, both in terms of performance, we're walking from the church to the grave, and we're all saying together, in the midst of life, we are in death. Where can we find our help except from you, O God? And everybody's saying this together. Now, you're also saying, I am the resurrection and the life at the same time. So one of the things I mentioned in this talk is the way that practically Christians in the tradition have held together, dialectically, the two views of the origin of death. Does God create us mortal, or is it just our fall that makes us mortal? And those two views are out there, and they have been for some time. But in practice, Christians have tended to say both at the same time. And we could go into how you manage that. But the Anglican prayer book is a wonderful example of this dialect, of holding, and take a look at the burial service, which begins, I'm the resurrection and the life, and ends with the, you know, in the midst of life, we are in death. These things together. Always. And in doing so, and you just have to look at the prayers. There's so much that Cranmer and his colleagues and so on. There's way more about the fact that we die, we're mortal, we're weak. Without you, we're nothing. We plead for your help and so on. It's all over the place. And it's one of the reasons modern revisers have said, you know, this is gloomy. This doesn't fit what we want to hear. I think it's wrong. That sense, I mean, I understand it, but I think it's misplaced to try to get rid of this tension in our life, because it's how we get to God. It's how God comes to us, is in this mortal, these mortal limitations that we acknowledge not only are ours, but are his, because he made us, and we're not our own. So I'm not going to go into details, but the prayer book, especially the classic prayer books, are filled. And you'll notice that if you pay attention and listen to some of it. Because sometimes you stop listening, I realize that. But pay attention to that. And if you go to other churches, or maybe you've been to other churches, whether they're Christian traditions or parishes or whatever, and listen to the kinds of things that are said, I mean, for heaven's sakes, we all have heard about churches that have removed crosses because they're considered a turnoff. Have you ever heard that? Sure. There are plenty of churches, especially big mega churches and so on, that are looking to draw people in, and they have removed images of the cross because they understand them to be too death involved. You would never find that. Let me just say one other thing about the Anglican thing related to this. Because obviously I said the body. Mortality is all about the body. It's also about God's commands about our body. One of the most traditional things that you will see in older Anglican churches, if you look at their altars, or around the chancel where the altar is, are the Ten Commandments. And in the classic Anglican prayer books, the communion service begins with the recitation of the Ten Commandments. Well, if you look at what the Ten Commandments are about, they're all about the transcendent God who's the creator of our bodily existence, and how do we live according to what God has given us, by honoring parents, by being faithful to our spouses, by not lying to our neighbors, and so on and so forth. So that was always a central part of the Anglican thing, and there were other Christian traditions who said, well, that's very legalistic. Anglicanism, you must understand, is a Protestant Reformed church that held on, I mean, proclaimed justification by faith and all the great doctrines of the Reformation, but held on to the great, if you will, traditional, medieval, but also all the way back, legal demands of God given in the scriptures. And that's why, you know, really tough Calvinists view Anglican, or Lutherans especially, view Anglicanism as sort of wimpy on the justification by faith side. I don't think that's fair. It's part of it is Anglicanism's rootedness in this notion of creation, immortal creation, and how God reveals himself to us in being our creator, in the cross especially. Anyway, I don't know if that answered you.
I have some more questions, but I'll open it to anybody else.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out exactly how to formulate this question. It has to do with the difference of opinions between mortality as an intrinsic or extrinsic thing, theologically understood. And I'm wondering if you could comment or if you have thoughts on how our view of that might change. There might be consensus with things like transhumanism or the sort of Silicon Valley attempts right now that I think are all, you know, ill-fated, but they seem to have hope that within a generation we can upload ourselves or figure out how to stop the aging process.
Yeah, well, that's one of the transhumanism, post-humanism project is sort of the epitome of the cultural trajectory that has viewed mortality as nothing good. You know, there's nothing good that can be said about it. Limitation, clearly, is an evil. And to the degree that we can keep getting beyond limits and going further and further, finally to no limits, we've reached what we should be. I mean, what can I say about that? I think most biologists consider it a fantasy. I mean, just from a scientific, physiological point of view, there's no way the human body can do that. Of course, we're going to put computers, we're going to upload whatever in our brain is into a computer. But just think about it. What would it mean to be a human person without your body? I mean, it might be something, but it would not be a human being. I mean, that's the whole point here. This is what God has given us. Now, maybe there's something else out there, but it wouldn't be this. So in one sense, there isn't a conversation to be had. If it's unrealistic, it's dangerous because it leads people to think in terms that go against the truth of who they are. If it's realistic, it's not faithful to receiving the gift God has given us. So either way, I mean, I go with it's utterly unrealistic. I mean, I don't think anybody really buys this. And we'll go further and say that all the attempts to make use of this are actually lead in directions of deep immorality. And I would put something like physician-assisted suicide and so on in that realm. I mean, what euthanasia is a kind of stepchild or sibling of eugenics, which is to get rid of that which doesn't work. When it doesn't work, whatever it doesn't work is defined by. It might just be pain, but we also know now it's a lot more than that. It's people like Rafi I mentioned. Do you realize that in the province of Quebec in Canada, they now are proposing legislation that will allow for the assisted killing, because it won't be suicide, of infants who are developmentally disabled. Already on the books, although it hasn't been put into effect, but it will next year in all of Canada, is physician-assisted suicide for teenagers who are depressed. Now, you have to fit a certain set of criteria, but believe me, I mean, this is going. Now, the whole point I'm bringing this up is to say that to look at a human life as if we're trying to get away from all this stuff and it's bad and perfection lies somewhere else almost always goes with these other things, which are, let's get rid of the things that are no longer fit this paradigm of where goodness lies. Unless we can truly say goodness lies with the bodies we have, we will devalue and ultimately destroy those bodies. That's human history, and you can look at it. I mean, that's my view of it anyway. So transhumanism is a... Anyway, I've said enough. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a fan. Did you pick that up? Anybody else? Yeah, please.
I'm also trying to formulate in a clear way. When you make the point that our life or mortality is a gift, that life's about reception and giving, it kind of reminds me, in a very opposite way, of the slogan, right to life. What do you think of this formulation that we have a right to life?
No, thank you. Thank you. I mean, the whole issue of birth and death is obviously wrapped up in our mortality. It's wrapped up. It's who we are. Children are born sometimes, often without planning, certainly in the past. So they're given. And they're given to us by God in the same way that we are given. And I think the term right could be misleading, and it plays into our own political culture of rights and so on, which aren't necessarily bad. They've done good things. But we are, it's way beyond a right, I guess is what I want to say. It's God at work. God is at work in putting a child into the world. And it's not so much the child has a right to exist. The child is God's gift. That's all it is. It's God at work. So it's more than, you know, I'm a strong believer in right to life, okay? But the phrase, I think, is in some sense too confined even. It's too constrained. It's who we are. And to kill babies or to terminate them is a kind of denial of who we are, and obviously then who God is. So it's the deepest, it's close to being an analogous thing to suicide. But, I mean, they're different. I'm not saying they're the same. And it's not so much, you know, suicide isn't, and by the way, I have suicide close in my family, so I'm not speaking here, you know, about other people. You know, why not let people who are in terrible pain and whose lives are intolerable, that's one of the terms that medically assisted suicide law talks, why not allow them to end their lives? Well, ending is also a gift. Beginning is a gift and ending is a gift. They're both God's. And yes, there's room around for us and sometimes very difficult to make decisions about these things. I'm not saying it's all always obvious. But I think the general contours are pretty clear. A child should be allowed to be born. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And people should be allowed to be taken by God in their natural deaths. And I'm not for keeping people alive at all costs and so on and so forth. You know, I think the Catholic Church actually has done a pretty good job in trying to sort some of these things out in a kind of technical way. It's hard, though. My wife and I just did a new will, and, you know, we have to put your end-of-life stuff in there and try to think, what are we supposed to tell our kids, you know? Because you don't know all the situations and so on. So we just put in, go consult the latest Catholic discussions with the priest, because they have worked this one out. They have worked this one out. I can't figure it out. But they have tried hard. But, yeah. Let things be born and see what happens. Let people die as they are taken and see how it happens rather than speed up the process or so on and so forth. Those are the two sides that I would see. There's a in the back and then another question here. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for the lecture. It was really informative. I guess I had one main really ever to me the concept of, like, I don't understand what the soul is, and it's like the thing that's kind of like led about by the body, and its fate is determined by the actions that are taken in the flesh. So, like, obviously, I assume that it wasn't like sort of like cultural depictions of the soul, like the ghost that like affects your body and like moves around, but the like reversal of like.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that, and it can be taken probably in an unhelpfully, concrete way. I mean, I think the whole image of body and soul is challenging, is problematic from a biblical perspective, not totally, but it's also inevitable at the same time. And so it's one of these things which we can't live without it, but also the more we press it, we get ourselves into logical and existential knots and confusions. So I think you're right to sort of look at it like the body is pulling the soul along on a leash. That separates the two. I mean, in some ways, the poem that I read is really a way of expressing how intimately linked they are, not how distinct they are. They are distinct in some way, and it would take obviously a long time to. That'd be a whole course trying to figure this one out. I do think, though, in our era, there's a lot of spiritualizing, where we talk about people. We say, "Oh, well, don't worry about what they did. They have a beautiful soul." And you know, sure, there are things we don't understand about people, but also the whole point is that the two are connected. Your soul and your body, that's pretty clear, scripturally speaking. So it's the connection, not so much the poem took it in a certain way. So what's your smallest question you think I might not want to answer? For what?
The
death penalty.
Which I am also not necessarily a proponent of. So I'm trying to understand more how people connect those two positions in my head.
Well, yeah. So on both counts, historically, views have developed within the Christian church. So if you look at scripture, there is no explicit prohibition of suicide. And there are certainly explicit laws governing capital offenses. So how did we get to a place where both of them are deeply problematic? Wherever you end up, I think everybody would agree they're both deeply problematic moral issues for Christians. And that's a long story in each case. Personally, I would be on the sort of whatever the, what's the Catholic term used? The unbroken cloth or whatever. What's the term? I'm sorry? Yeah, well, no, but I think they're right about this. In general, the concern, there's a deep concern about the death penalty and opposition to it mostly, and that they see as consistent with other elements, pro-life, to use the other side of the term, being against euthanasia and abortion and so on. I do think they're all related, and how that all came to be came about with an increasing reflection on scripture, Old Testament included, and the New Testament, and as well as on human experience in that sense. What have people done with their laws? I mean, one of the problems is that we can all think of theoretical situations where permissions probably make sense. You know, we have the extreme cases for everything, including capital punishment. And yet, first of all, we rarely work in extreme cases. We work with normal life. And when we put extreme cases to work to inform our normal decisions, we go way off track a lot. So whether, you know, I'm not sure I'm a pacifist, I'm speaking now about myself, in some kind of principled way. And yet I can't think that it's ever a good idea to go to war. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there are times when it's pushed into it, and that we can say that here is where we have ended up. And that's a little bit like mortality. We're pushed into a place where something that seems awful is just thrown on us. And then you have to accept it in some way. And I think that's true for some of these very difficult situations. But when you make them principles for daily life, it is such a temptation to start applying them to all kinds of situations. I like the assisted suicide one. Everybody said, who was opposed to it on the front end, you do this. This sounds great. Somebody's in horrible, horrible pain, and they're not going to get better. Why not just let them die by giving them some drugs? And most people would say, I'm serious. Most people would say, I see that. But the people from the front end of this said, you do that, and then, and you're going to start redefining what terrible pain is, to the point where you now have 13-year-olds who are clinically depressed. It doesn't make sense. So better not do it at all. I'm a believer in the slippery slope in this regard. Anyway, I've been going on that. Yes?
So I think the term you're looking for is seamless garment.
Seamless garment, thank you. Yeah.
The question I had as you were talking about the intrinsic or extrinsic aspect of mortality, and you said that you think those can go together, but also there's that tension with the idea of the fall, and if mortality is associated with the fall, what does that mean? Does this require essentially like a Felix Kalpa idea that the fall is in some way a good thing
Well, so the intrinsic view, as I said, claims that our mortality comes with our creation before the fall, right? And some theologians have had that, including back and forth Augustine. Now, his view was that we're created mortal, but God's hope or intention for human beings was that they would be obedient, and in their obedience they would be graced, and in their grace they would reach immortality, as it were. So created mortal with a purpose towards immortality. And the fall came in and messed up that smooth movement into immortality that the mortal creature was meant to have, and made mortality a permanent feature that human beings, in a sense, grabbed hold of. So that was the way he looked at it. The extrinsic view, which is, by the way, the most common view in other world religions, so Christianity is no different in this. Most world religions say that, death came in through some, the evil god or the spirit or the stupid man or stupid woman. I mean, these are common things. They messed it all up. But it shouldn't have been that way. The Bible does have a lot of things to say about death and sin being intimately related. And it's not easy to get around some of the verses in the New Testament that link death with human sin rather than with God's creation. But there are ways that theologians have done so. So the power of death is the result of sin. But does that mean that death itself is something that, anyway, I don't have to go into all of that, but people have found ways to do that. I think the real issue is that as both Judaism and Christianity share both of these intrinsic, extrinsic dialectics, is trying to take account. You said the felix culpa, that's in Latin for the happy fault. In other words, that the fall, even though it was a real fall, God allowed it to happen because he knew it would result in the incarnation and the death on the cross, and that was even better. So he allowed something bad to happen for the sake of something good. That's a little more mechanistic than some of the intrinsicists have said. They would rather say that our relationship with death has just gotten so messed up because of the fall. And you can see why. We kill people. We organize our lives in ways that are utterly unfaithful because of both our fear of death, our attempts to escape it, and so on and so forth, so that we are in the power of death. Extrinsicists would say, yes, but God wants us to live with him. That's why he made us. And so intrinsicists would want to say the same thing, but it's the question of how do we value who we are? And as I say, both Jewish and Christian, it's a minority view, the intrinsicist view, I have to say, in the tradition. But it's real. And because the church never defined it, there was never a count. There might be individual groups who say this is how you have to think. But there have never been any common agreements about the origin of death and its meaning. It's fascinating. Why haven't Christians done that? I think one reason is because, this goes to an earlier conversation about, you know, lifespans and all that and our culture, is because death was always with us. You know, I always use this example because it's the easiest to get your mind around. In the year 1900, the average lifespan for a Canadian was 40 years old. In the year 2000, it was 80 years old. It doubled in 100 years, exactly. And before 1900, a lot of that death was driven by infant mortality and maternal mortality at childbirth. What it meant was that every child probably had a sibling or their closest friends who died as a child, or a mother. And every spouse had probably had their first wife eventually die at childbirth. And you know, it wasn't just women who died early. Women had their husbands die. Anyway, everybody had death wrapped up in their life. Now, you had a choice, as I said. You could either say, this life is just rotten to the core. You know, Job's wife. Why don't you curse God and die? But that was always viewed as the wrong response. Why curse God? And there was a famous rabbi, and he is one of the top early rabbis in the Talmud, Rabbi Meir, who says in the Talmud, it's recorded in the Talmud, he said, God made the light, this was good, God, this was good, he made the hippos, they were good, he made the flies, they were good, he made human beings, they were good, he made death, and it was good. He actually says that. Now that's really going far in articulating this. But how could we say God makes good things and then curse God and die? And I think people realize that we had to make our peace with death as being part of God's, whatever God is doing for us, part of that. That may not be going so far as to say felix culpa, but it's getting there. It's getting there. Yeah. These are really great questions, but they also go to the sort of really profound and difficult place this takes us, where I think clear definitions should be, we should be wary of that, because we are talking about, yes, 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 yes. Oh, therefore, yeah. You go ahead, Romani, is that it? Romani. You're asking a very interesting question about sort of non-human creatures, angels. And it goes to things like the resurrection. Where Jesus says, you know, you don't get married or given in marriage in heaven, you'll be like the angels. But of course, Paul says that we will have a body in the resurrection. He calls it a spiritual body, but it is a body. And he's very clear, it is a body. He throws out the idea that there is no resurrection, only something else. Bodies transformed. So whatever Satan is and whatever human beings are, they're very different. They're very different, even in the resurrection. We do not, we are like angels, but we are not angels. We are resurrected bodies, spiritual bodies. Is it possible for angels to sin? The answer is yes, clearly, as you said. And people have talked about that. So sin is not only the body. But see, that goes to this question of the origin of death itself. Is death just sin? Is it the result of sin? Have we died because we made a bad choice or an evil choice? And I tend to be more on the intrinsicist side of this dialectic. I have to admit that. It would come as no surprise. But it doesn't mean, because I think sin is sort of independent of bodily existence per se. It's not independent of creation. A lot of things are created. So the key thing, the key distinction is creator and creature here. But not all creatures are mortal human beings. There are creatures who are others, cherubs, seraphim. We don't even know what they are, but we have names for them and we're led to believe in them. And Satan as an angel would be one of those. So I wouldn't want to say that sin is simply spiritual. Sin comes from creatureliness. But creatures are formed in different ways. We don't really know how angels are formed, because we're not told. We do know how human beings are formed, of dust and the breath of God. That's it. So I didn't quite answer your question, but I tried to push it aside.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, they do, but we're not that. That's the point.
Yeah, but there's sin.
And there's
sin.
Yeah. Okay. That's all. And sin comes from the creature, whether spiritual or not. Yeah, well, that doesn't quite work either. Right. Yeah. I agree with you on that. Yeah. Jared, and then there were two questions on this side. We can't know everything.
Right.
We can't do everything.
Right.
We can't feel everything. Right. We don't get away from limits, even if there were no fall,
yeah.
Even if there were no redemption. I mean, even if there is a redemption, there are limits. Whatever we do. And that's why in some views of heaven, you know, famously Gregory of Nyssa, these early fathers and so on, heaven is an eternal movement, a progress into knowledge of God. You're never steady, because you could never reach the term of a full knowledge of God. You could only keep going and going and getting closer and closer without ever reaching. I mean, but that's a similar sort of thing, because we're not God at all, ever. So I think that's right. Yeah. Okay, there were a couple questions back here. Well, furthest back and then farther up. We'll do it that way.
This is very much more of a personal practical question.
Sure. I mean, one of the hardest things for me as a parent is to raise children who are not constantly disappointed or feel bad about themselves because they don't achieve whatever their dreams are, whatever their hopes are, and so on. So every parent has to do that, and always has in some way, right? And it's hard in this culture, right? Because you're made to feel if you can't get X, you're a failure. I mean, the word failure is a fascinating word. That's a modern word, at least as applied to a person. A person who is a failure. an odd idea when you think about it. But our children are taught that all the time. So how to help? I'm trying to give myself time to think this through personally. I mean, I've been disappointed in all kinds of dreams and hopes that I had, and they weren't easy. See, part of the problem is I don't know that there's an easy way to sort of become a non-disappointed person because one accepts one's limitations. Because I think disappointment is part of, it's what you do with your disappointments, I guess. For me, I can only say that they have driven me to God. When they haven't simply torn me apart, they have driven me to God. And the greatest discipline, I'll tell you what the greatest discipline for me was always reading the Psalms. I mean, you want a practical thing, is just reading the Psalms. Because the Psalms, there are some people who do well in the Psalms. But there's a lot more of the psalmist who says, you know, my best friends don't like me anymore, and my, you know, I'm besieged in a city, and I've been hurting since I was young, and so on and so forth. And you, O Lord, are my hope. And the two things for me is you, O Lord, that's the first thing, are my hope. But there's also the sense that I can be a part of the, if you will, the most magnificent group of people who has ever been talked about, in this case, David and Israel. I can be a part of them precisely in my not having gotten into this school or not being able to do X or Y or having somebody I love die. I can be a part, I can share the life of the ancestor of the Messiah in that place. And of course, sharing that life also means sharing all the vision and the joys and the glories. So how about reading the Psalms? Start with that one. Start with that one. Because after all, you know, it is God's grace. This isn't something that we sort of manufacture our feelings for, I don't think. We open ourselves to God's gifts and to allow our failures, to use that modern term, to become gifts can only happen if we can see the giver. That means more and more God and less us in some way. So that'd be one suggestion. Yeah. Yeah. You've been waiting very patiently. Well, yeah. I'm not sure how individuals conceive of their souls. I mean, this person or that person or whatever. So, it's a very. I mean, we can talk about souls, obviously, in either biblical terms or dogmatic terms, but perceiving my soul is an interesting question, and I'm not asking you to say how you perceive your soul. I'm not sure how I perceive my soul. But whatever it is, I mean, do I perceive it in these hopes, these intuitions that seem to, you know, we can speak more mystically, whatever, of connecting me with God and so on? Maybe. But whatever it is, it's no more and no less a gift than my body. They are not comparative value things. You know, the soul is more important than the body. Now, Jesus says, you know, don't fear those who can kill your body, fear those who can kill your soul. But I'm not sure that's because the soul is worth more than the body. It's because we already know about our bodies being taken from us, and our souls are the things that 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 we're not aware of as much, and we have to be aware of the deep values that God gives us in the whole of our creation. But they're both equally gifts of God. So I'm not sure. I worry when people play one against the other, as if this is less important and this is more important. And your soul is eternal, but your body is limited. Well, that's true, except for the fact that your body is what gets resurrected. I mean, you can't get a, there isn't a resurrected soul and not a resurrected body. It doesn't exist. I mean, this whole issue of what happens when you die to your soul, boy, you look at the history of Christian theology on that if you want a multitude of arguments that nobody agrees on. Does the spirit go to heaven right away while the body waits for the resurrection of the dead? Does the spirit sleep along with the body next to it? Does the body go somewhere else in its form, but not its full resurrection? Nobody has a clue. Well, they may think they have clues, but nobody agrees. So exactly how you coordinate the two, it seems to me, is an open question. It's utterly necessary to hold them each as an equal value, however distinct they are in our sensibilities about what each is, as equal value, an infinite value. Our bodies are of infinite value. They're infinite value in their mortality, though. They're not of infinite value. You see what I'm saying? It's like listening to a piece of music. You only hear it once. If you heard it over and over again, not just over and over again, but that's all that was your reality was, I don't know what your favorite song would be, but by the way, that is torture. That is one of the ways people torture people. I was just listening to an interview yesterday about these two American mercenary soldiers who got captured by the Russians in Ukraine, and they were for 2 months, 3 months, they were tortured. And one of the ways they were tortured was by having music blare all day and all night long. And this is a well-known technique. Anyway, a song is beautiful because it ends. It's not less beautiful because it comes to an end.
Can I add that it was ABBA that they were playing for the
Is that what, you heard the same interview?
Yeah,
okay. Not all music is created equal too. But still, it wouldn't be music if it didn't have a beginning and an ending. It wouldn't be beautiful if it didn't have a beginning and an ending. And our bodies wouldn't have their eternal value, the eternal value in God's eyes, if they did not begin and did not end, and were not then resurrected. Now, spirits are different, and I am not sure where to put that on the kind of mortality spectrum. Although, it's quite possible that God can kill spirits too, annihilation. There's a whole Christian tradition about that, of annihilationism, where things, you know, God brings things into being and off they go. So I'm not trying to create more problems, only to say that I think that this sense that these are two different entities, but each in their own way, body and spirit, I'm saying, each in their own way, come from God utterly and have the value that the infinite God gives to what God makes.
Do you mind?
I don't mind. Keep going. Okay,
going.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll go from the back and then forward.
And you could also add to that point, obviously the soul and body have infinite value, but the soul or the body as they're created with different disability, etc., cognitive ability, if it was lived there, they also have infinite value, created and defined now. So I just kind of wanted to address that as you mentioned, kind of the personal thing.
Absolutely. Thank you. And it's true. Absolutely. It would make no sense, anything I said were what you just said, not true. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. The one thing that you were talking about is how mortality is a good. And you were just talking about how so much of our sort of work and value, in some sense, is derived from our mortality, from our limitedness. Is there a sense in which there's a deficiency in an eternal life?
Because we don't experience mortality anymore?
Because death is no more. There is no more crying, pain, death, tears. So is there something, based on the theology that you just outlined, that says that is there's a deficiency in that state of immortality?
Go ahead.
Then is there, based on what you're saying at the end of your lecture, is there a sense in which redemption is itself sort of life and death being sort of enjoined in some mysterious infusion?
Yeah, well, I would say the latter, without question, so I won't have to say any more than that. I answered that, yes. The first one about, immortality, heaven. I was talking to a friend of mine whose 29-year-old son was killed in a car accident last year, and a very faithful Christian. And we were talking about heaven. And I don't know how it came up. One of the questions was, in heaven, will I simply forget all the grief I've just been going through and still am? Will it be like wiping my memory away? And he says, I can't believe that either, because that embodies my love. Now it's going to be some, he says, I'm sure it will be transfigured. It won't feel, it won't be so horrendous or whatever as it can be waking up in the middle of the night knowing my son is dead. But on the other hand, it will somehow have gathered up those deepest feelings that I've been experiencing and not simply throw them away. Like, that was a mistake for that time. Sorry you had to go through it. But now everything can be back. And that's the best I can do with this question of, will we miss? I don't think immortality will be missing the goods of mortality. But I don't know what it means that they won't miss them. Just as I said, the lamb that was slain is the one who everybody worships in heaven, the throne room of God. How can that be? I don't know what it can be. But anyway, that's the best I can do.
Thank you, Professor Radniska. Thank you.